Without more, we will leave the world on a pathway to 2.7 degrees, and with more, we are still likely to get to 2 degrees. How many more voices and how many more pictures of people must we see without being able to move? Or are we so blinded and hardened that we can no longer appreciate the cries of humanity? For those who have eyes to see, for those who have ears to listen, and for those who have a heart to feel, 1.5 is what we need to survive. 2 degrees is a death sentence for the people of Antigua and Barbuda, for the people of Dominica and Barbados.
Welcome everyone to the Caribbean Science Fiction Network, a celebration of all things fantasy, folklore, speculative fiction, and of course, science fiction. You just heard the Prime Minister of Barbados, Mia Mottley, implore world leaders to lead with their hearts, as well as to listen to the cries of humanity. But where can literature help to change our hearts, as well as open our eyes to a shared humanity, particularly during a climate crisis? Today I have with me Diana McCauley, the Jamaican writer of the 2020 novel, Daylight Come.
I thought there hadn't been a really explicit novel on what the climate crisis would mean for an island like Jamaica. You know, what would happen if it was really too hot for us to go outside in the day? We couldn't farm, we couldn't repair roads, we couldn't paint a building, couldn't move around.
So Dana, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Jarrell. I'm happy to be here.
The first thing I want us to talk about is the inspiration behind this novel, as well as how important it was for you to incorporate speculative fiction tropes as a Caribbean writer.
I read a story of construction workers falling from scaffolding in the Middle East because of the extreme heat. And it got me thinking about a world where it became too hot to go outside in the day, at least much of the year. So I started thinking about it in the way that you do and imagined life in the Caribbean and thought about how much of our occupation, how much of our way of life is outdoors. And when I returned home, I started to observe that. I just started to take note of how many people were outside during the day. And that's where the thinking behind the novel began. You know, what would happen if it was really too hot for us to go outside in the day? We couldn't farm, we couldn't repair roads, we couldn't paint a building, couldn't move around. And then I imagined, well, if that happened, maybe we would change life around and we would, you know, start working at night when it was cooler and sleep in the day. Although the book is set in a fictional Caribbean island, you know, I imagined a mountainous island, and she wants to convince her mother to leave the coastal city for the hills where she hears there are, first of all, youngsters her own age, because people rarely see each other in person, you know, except at the workplace. All of school is online. And she convinces her mother to leave the coastal city of Bana and head for the hills, you know, which is a trope, as you said. So it's a story of their efforts to find, you know, a way of life that they sense is much more normal than the one they're forced to live because of climate breakdown. And the novel is set in 2084 as well, a little nod to Mr. Orwell. That's the basic premise and how it came about.
Of course, you're not just a writer, you're also an environmental activist. So I wanted to get a sense from you, how does each inform the other and how both contributed to this book?
I know that you can't preach in a novel. You can't say, no, here's my point of view, pay attention, I'm going to dump this on you, right? So first and foremost, it still has to stand alone as a story. But one of the things I came to learn in my 30 years of being an activist is that, you know, where I started in the beginning, I had this view that I needed to get the facts right. And so I put a lot of emphasis on study, on research, on presenting the facts of not just the climate crisis, but various other environmental issues. But I came to feel that actually it was less about people's minds and more about their hearts. Therefore, a very powerful tool for changing people's hearts is storytelling. And of course, we have a really great and long tradition of storytelling in the Caribbean. So, you know, my books are not, except for this one, they're not overtly environmental, but I hope they all have this really strong sense of place and grounding and efforts to ask people to think about our relationships with the place that we live in. So that's really where I stand now, that it's important that we engage people's emotions rather than their minds and talk about the place that we call home, but sometimes treat in a very careless way, even damaging way.
On that point of how to engage people's hearts as well as their minds, the Prime Minister of Barbados, Mia Mottley, recently spoke at the COP26 climate conference. And in essence, she implored world leaders to lead with their hearts and listen to the cries of humanity. And I want to ask you, how do you see your role as a writer and an environmental activist doing this work, trying to change people's hearts, as well as opening our eyes to a sense of a shared humanity during a climate crisis?
So one of the things I learned over the almost 30 years of being an activist was that it's important to know your facts, but it's really passion that persuades people. And so one of the things I admired about Prime Minister Motley's speech was her use of both of those things. I mean, she spoke with a much greater specificity than many other leaders that I saw, but also she spoke from her heart, the sort of passion that she brought to the subject and the seriousness of the impacts of the climate crisis on her country were very apparent. And I think one of the things that causes people to, you know, appreciate a problem, rally to a problem, start thinking about it, talking about it, are stories. So that's sort of where my activist life and my writing life began to overlap. Because I began to think about how can I tell stories that will reach people's hearts, that will make this crisis real to them. One of the problems about the climate crisis is the way it's been framed for so long is it's very far off in the future, you know, something that may not necessarily affect me personally. And I think one of the things I wanted to do with Daylight Come was ask the people of the Caribbean who are reading it, specifically them, but of course others who have perhaps visited the Caribbean, what would our worlds look like in 2084? What would our islands look like in 2084 if it became really too hot to go out during the day for most of the year? And I hoped that readers, if their imaginations are engaged and they started thinking about that, maybe the person reading has an outdoor occupation or works for a company with outdoor workers, or they would simply start to drive around and observe how many people were outside during the day, that would first engage their imaginations and their concerns and then lead them perhaps to becoming part of the struggle that is probably one of the more vital ones humanity has faced.
Let's talk about how the novel is using technology, because there's the plaque, which the characters have to rely on. But there are limitations with it. It needs to charge, it doesn't work all the time. So I get a sense that you're speaking to the limitations of technology, as well as our dependence on it.
I imagine a world where a lot of modernity had collapsed, but not everything, because I think there are going to be some technological solutions. You know, we are going to find ways to use algae, for instance, as food, and there are going to be sources of energy like solar that we are going to use. So it's not completely a world where we're back living in caves, although there are quite a few caves in the book. So it was this, what I wanted was this mix of the things we take for granted now about modern life having broken down, but there are some technological solutions. And I thought the one that we really needed, if we're trying to get people from a coastal city into the mountains, they'd need some way of finding themselves there, you know? And that's why I thought it would be good to have some kind of computer device. I don't tell you I had any particular inspiration for it, you know, just a modern tablet, I think, is what I had in my mind, but something that, you know, was a little bit illicit to have and very prized and people would really want if they knew you had it. So it would be a bargaining tool as they went along. So that really was the thought between this device. And I, you know, I thought about the satellites in the sky, which we are so unaware of as we go about our normal lives. You know, we don't know much about them really, at least the average person doesn't. And I thought, well, what happened if there were these gaps in the coverage of the internet, you know. So life was more like old time black and white photographs, you know, taken with a camera and projected onto a screen, and they would flicker and there'd be these big sort of spaces in them. That's the sort of imaginative framework I had for the plaque.
I feel like we need to talk about the title of the novel, because I see it being informed by yourself as a Jamaican, given the borrowing from the Jamaican folk song. However, as opposed to this song, which tells a story of people doing this laborious task at night and then waiting for daylight to come so they can go home, in the novel, the characters cannot be in the daylight. So how are you using the folk song together with your role as an environmental activist slash writer?
I thought there hadn't been a really explicit novel on what the climate crisis would mean for an island like Jamaica. And I made it a fictional island because that gives you freedom, you know. You then don't have people writing you to say, no, you can't put that road there because it's not there. You have some freedom to just imagine whatever, you know. Imagine that the mountains are 3 days walk away instead of 2 weeks, you know. So that's why I made it a fictional island, but I definitely wanted this Caribbean sensibility. Now, as to the title, my father used to sing this song to me, Daylight Come, you know, and he had it on a record, Harry Belafonte. And so it's a sort of a nod back to my own childhood. And I think you're absolutely right about the message of the song, that, you know, there's this laborious task, the banana pickers, they want the day to come and then they want to go home. Those are the two ideas there. And I thought it was perfect for what I was trying to say, which is that what would happen if this hopeful time that dawn has represented for humanity, you know, the darkness of the night receding and a new day coming, what would happen if that was something that we all had to come to dread, because daylight come was going to bring dangers. And also the sort of recurring theme of wanting to go home, the meaning of home, what does home give us in a situation where everything that we knew of about home has been destroyed or is in the process of being destroyed. So the title seemed perfect to me. I'm quite bad at titles, so I start writing and it's ages, even right through a first draft, and then I'm going through edit before the title comes to me. But that's what this one eventually came, and I think it's really perfect for what I'm trying to say.
You mentioned struggling to find a title for the novel, and I think it's a good opportunity now to mention the struggle for naming that happens during the novel, particularly as it relates to the convergence, which the novel makes a point of saying it was not just the climate crisis, but also poverty and history and all these things coming together as part of the climate crisis. So say a bit about the aspects of naming in the novel as it relates to being a writer slash environmental activist.
Well, I think something that people often don't appreciate is the threat multiplier effect of the climate crisis. So we tend to look at it in a kind of box, you know, oh, there's this climate crisis over there, it's climate breakdown, more benignly climate change. But it's going to make all the current challenges that the Caribbean and islands like the Caribbean in the Pacific too face worse. So it's going to multiply the threats that we currently have. And I'm a little bit obsessed with naming, which is something you'll also see in all my books. And I think sometimes we try to avoid issues by the naming of them, you know, and then there becomes a debate about what to call it. And you can see that in the environmental movement with sustainable development. And, you know, I've even started to see people refer to mining as sustainable. And you see that with the climate crisis as well. And the little passage in the book where it says, you know, they called it the emergency, they called it the climate change and the crisis, global warming, all these different terms that have been used. I see them as distancing. I see them as a distraction, a deflection from really facing the problem. So that's what I wanted to talk about, how, in fact, a climate crisis is coming on top of a lot of things: history, colonialization, genocide, profoundly unequal societies, and it's going to make all of that worse. And it's upon us.
Staying with the idea of struggles But moving away from naming, in the novel, the tribals, whom we are told will like the Tainos, they also struggle as excluded people, as people pushed to the margins, also being affected in this climate crisis. So I wanted to know, I'm curious to know how focusing on these indigenous populations factored in to your examination of the climate crisis. That's a mouthful.
I'm very interested in Jamaica's, well, all the Caribbean islands' original inhabitants, you know, and so I try to include some echoes of them in all my books, because in a very real sense, all of us who live in the Caribbean now are all new arrivals. You know, I know that now there's work showing the genetic persistence of the Taino peoples, but their cultures and their civilization was essentially wiped out, you know, so our islands have this origin in genocide. So I'm very interested in how those earlier peoples managed to live in this place we find ourselves, you know. I mean, were they better at it? Did they cause less damage? I want to avoid, you know, any kind of, I guess, noble savage story, you know. I want to avoid failing to face that maybe they too did their damages, you know. And I also want to ask, so here you have a modern society that has been, its modernity has all but collapsed. And to have a more normal, in quotation marks, life, or a more pleasant life, a greater quality of life, they have to go to a place where people are living in the quote-unquote old way. And I was interested in what would happen. Would we in that desperate situation, would we still continue to have in-groups and out-groups? Would we attempt to recreate the kind of society that we were having to leave? Would we have learned any lessons from the way we live among each other? So that's why I was interested in, you know, how indigenous people live with the land, what sacrifices they make, what becomes important to them. And I really wanted these two protagonists fleeing, you know, what's left of modernity in their island to these other ways of living, how they would navigate that encounter and how the tribal peoples would view them as well. And then there's this other aspect to the novel, which is about the gap between the young and the old. So the young really blame the old for what's upon them and what has happened. And they feel like the old have, you know, they had these very pleasant lives, these very privileged lives, used up all the resources, including the change, the atmosphere, which, you know, it's very hard to think of a more dramatic set of damage than that. And also when they're older, they become a drag on the society, you know, they're just eating and but not contributing. So there's that dimension between, or that tussle between the old and the young. And, you know, the tribals of course think old people are not very useful, and that's something the two protagonists have to grapple with when they do encounter the tribals.
Something that caught my attention was, I think it was Sorrel who remembered Emrali's words, "I don't think about humanity." So I just want you to touch on the question of humanity as it relates to the overall climate crisis that is being framed in the novel. What was your purpose with this connection to humanity?
Well, vital, because I wanted to say that the peoples of more modernity who have lost their way, who don't really know how to survive outside of the support of a city, were going to need the people who had figured it out. But in Daylight comes also a story of relationships between women. So I wanted to explore as well a friendship between, you know, or an admiration between these two girls, Emrali and Sorrel. And of course, the relationship between Sorrel and her mother, Bibi. So it's a lot about the relationships between women, navigating those, seeing what happens when women, you know, take on leadership roles. Do they behave differently to men? What kind of society would we have if we separated into groups of women and groups of men? What kind of society would we have if women were in charge? How do elites behave in a situation like this? And do they as well continue the ways that they have historically done, you know, using threat and punishment and enslavement to get their desires? So these are some of the questions I wanted to ask in a situation where everything we know has broken down. Do we build the same Caribbean again?
You mentioned the two protagonists, and in that case, how important was it for you to write about the lowlander, Sorrel, befriending the tribal, Emrali? And tied to my earlier question about the plaque, how important was it to have these indigenous peoples, to have the lowlanders at their mercy while the plaque could not be found?
I want to ask what happens in a situation of desperate survival. So you're worried about living another day. Do you think about those big questions like, you know, how do I behave to fellow human beings, or do we all grab for the last breadfruit and the last fish? So I wanted something of a interaction between the girl who is on the idealistic side and inclined to think about humanity, perhaps just because her grappling with the survival issues is much more recent, and Emrali, who is much more pragmatic and is not really thinking about humanity at all and is just focused on how much of the breadfruit she's going to get. I wanted that conversation to occur because two different ways of facing a really dire situation. And I think in reality and history has shown that both types of approach emerge. So what do those people talk about? How do they get over this different view? Is there any meeting of the minds?
You mentioned the satellites, and something that really caught my attention was the inclusion of the Americans, and it's spelled with a K. They seem to be deliberately controlling the environment, including outer space, with these satellites. In terms of the power dynamics, again, acting on this fictional island, what were you getting at with the inclusion of these people?
I wanted to talk about the continuation of the power dynamics that we see now. You know, the United States of America is a 100-pound gorilla in the room, and I imagined that they would not simply evaporate. And I started thinking about, well, what happens if, and to a degree, this is playing out in front of us right now, as we see all the impacts of the climate crisis in developed countries. You know, I started asking myself, what if a place like Jamaica, this fictional island called Badger Coo, was more attractive to the developed countries? What if there was a kind of reverse migration? What if they wanted to conquer us again because we had fresh water, because we had the elevation of the mountains? There were desirable things about being here compared to where they were, where both coasts, you know, one coast is sinking, the other coast is burning up, the middle of that country is can't grow food anymore. Would they want to come here? And what would happen if they did? So, and the naming, I went back to old maps because I see in history this tendency to rename things. You know, you're a conqueror, you go to a place and the place already has a name, right? Given by the people who live there. And you, the conqueror, just name it something else. And then several hundred years later, there's some pushback against that. And the original peoples, if they're still present, say, no, this is the name of this place. And the name ought not to have been changed. And it's often... The naming is often for places where the conquerors or colonizers have come from, or people. So I went back to old maps to see what the Caribbean islands were originally named in the Taino language. And I browsed some Taino words, and some of the words I've used are actual Taino words, and others I just made them up. I like the way they sounded. And that's why I changed the spelling of America. I wanted to call into question. I wanted to say that in 2084, there's been some renaming, again a deflection, again a claiming of these sites. So that's why I changed the spelling.
So Dana, we're almost at the end of the chat, but I wanted to ask you, is there anything else you want to leave us with before you go?
I don't think many of us, we'd prefer not to think about the climate crisis, I think. I would prefer not to have to think about it. But we are being, we must think about it. We must understand that it is our civilization that is being threatened. And we must not give in to the arguments, which I've seen this morning already, you know, oh, it's too late to do anything about it. It's not too late to do anything about it. And the question that I often get asked is, what can I do on an individual level? And I guess I'd like to say the most important thing any individual can do is start talking to your friends and relatives, your own circle of influence, and use those circles of influence. Tell people that you're concerned about this. Start reading, start going to meetings, start commenting on social media, become a really engaged citizen around this critical issue.
So, Diana, I want to thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you for talking to me, Gerald.
And to everyone listening, thank you as well. Continue to stay tuned to the Caribbean Science Fiction Network. Bye.